top of the news this evening is speculation concerning the real facts behind the Department of Health announcement about a radioactive spill supposed to have occurred yesterday at the state nuclear plant.
You will die only to live again in a younger body. Then you can tell me if the operation was a success. I could easily kill you now, but I'm determined to have your brain.
You're listening to the Really Awful Movies Podcast, a celebration of genre cinema. Hi, my name is Chris, and along with Jeff, we talk about movies that aren't really awful at all. Horror, action, kung fu, musicals, post-apocalyptic, women in prison films, and much, much more.
From our downtown Toronto headquarters, here's episode 316 of the Really Awful Movies Podcast. My top 20 favorite horror films of all time. Now for this list, it's favorite rather than best. And for the sole purpose that this enables me to be a little more idiosyncratic with my choices, whereas with a top 10 list of the best, you're going to have a lot of sameness, or at least one would think there would be a lot of overlap and consensus on the matter. Also, at the conclusion of this list, we'll point out the ones that are particularly glaring omissions for people in this space. I might point that out. And also the reason that one particular era is predominant at the expense of more modern efforts and taking place in the last 10 to 15 years. And maybe get into some of those as well. And this is in no particular order as well. And to keep the off-the-cuff, extemporaneous nature of the podcast, I've got a couple of notes and some marginalia to go off of, but it's mostly just going to come off the top of my head, and I may suggest alternates too. So let us begin. Number one, Maniac. This one is the Bill Lustig classic that I first came upon in a movie reference guide I had that was penned by Leonard Maltin, and he gave this film BOMB, which was his acronym for, well, probably still is his acronym for, bottom of the movie barrel. Used specifically for effort that he held completely beneath contempt, that were even lower than his scale rating of half a star, I believe. So it was something that was not worthy of anyone's time whatsoever. And that was a movie I read about, and of course that would be on my radar as something I would check out just by the plot. And he was very dismissive of it, saying just some sicko maniac goes and murders people in the streets of New York City. But there's more to it than that. Joe Spinell's indelible portrayal of the title maniac, and the internalizing of the examination of the inner mindset of the killer, which is something completely unique to the genre, which usually had not particularly self-reflective sorts, usually masked, and usually not ones for dialogue. But this Bill Lustig turned it on its ear and developed that conceit whereby the killer was isolated and going through his own personal monologue. And for those who haven't seen it, it's about a loner who has a collection of mannequins back at his seedy apartment. And it's really, really intense, it's really creepy, and it really delivers the goods. And surprisingly, so does the Elijah Wood remake, where they decamped and went to LA, and it's surprisingly effective. And both of them very similar plot beats, because I guess both of them are into photography, and so there's an aesthetic element as well. At one of the recent Toronto Horrorama horror conventions, Jeff and I had the opportunity to sit down and record a podcast with Bill Lustig, the film's director, which is a really amazing thrill. Although unfortunately, because of the ambient noise, it didn't turn out the greatest, but we urge listeners to check it out. And I was able to at least say that, express the sentiments that this is the all-time greatest slasher film, and alternating in my estimation with Halloween. But you could say they're two sides of the same coin. One is more akin to the faceless, mysterious, masked killer who just butchers people indiscriminately, and the other one is more internalized psychological horror. Number two, Frank Henenlotter's Brain Damage. Henenlotter is, of course, known for Basket Case, and in which is terrific and would have almost made the cut for this list as well, because it's just so charming. But Brain Damage is an extended allegory of drug use and drug abuse, and it features the symbiosis and symbiotic relationship between a man and a creature that injects fluid into his neck, named Aylmer. And it sounds like a stupid premise, but the two of them become inextricably linked, and much in the way of horror ensues. It's extremely underrated, and much like Hennenlauter's other efforts, it has some incredible practical effects, and one of the most just intense, let's put it this way, sex scenes you'll ever see in a horror film. And just, I mean, it's a little bit on the cheap side. It's cheap and cheerful practical effects, but it's so whip smart and really captures the spirit of that time, and manages to pair a social message with some genuine thrills and a few laughs along the way too. Just something that I can always appreciate as we segue into the next film, which is Reanimator by Stuart Gordon. Could have added From Beyond as a tie with this one, because frequently they're put in the same category, as they're both based on H.P. Lovecraft short stories. And I use the term based loosely because they use a snippet of the source material and then they go on to create their own milieus completely independent of Lovecraft's work. In Reanimator, it's a hilarious and low budget retelling of the Frankenstein, Mary Shelley Frankenstein tale, with a mad scientist who looks to bring the dead to life, to reanimate them, as the title would suggest, using this green serum that he first develops on a cat. And quite humorously, when he gets the cat reanimated, he says, it says something effective, don't expect it to tango or some such thing. But this one, along with From Beyond, both feature mad scientists and Miskatonic University, and incredible performances, by Jeffrey Combs and Barbara Crampton, and subplots involving professional jealousy and the publisher parish academic world of the university. And when the doctor eventually reanimates one of his colleagues, they're just all hell breaks loose. And there's two amazing villains who stand in, although you could call Jeffrey Combs' character a villain as well, but that would be Herbert West. But his antagonists are Dr. Hill and Dr. Pretorius, and they are fantastic, funny, avuncular foil to his sort of wimpish egghead character persona. And the gore is off the charts once again. The practical effects are just rip-roaring, and there's some great lines preceding a decapitation. One character accuses the other of being a plagiarist before he lops his dome off, and it's very, very funny. On a completely different note, or as Monty Python would say, now for something completely different, Martyrs, at my number four, part of the French New Wave of horror, and one that has stuck with me in the two times I've seen it, and involves the experimentation on a young girl who's being kept in a basement. And without spoiling it, the denouement is something really out of this world, but it has a similar, torture porn approach that was used by people like Eli Roth and people around the mid-2000s. Although in this case, it's so extreme psychologically that it can't help but differentiate itself. And it doesn't lacks the silver and cheesy blue cinematography that a lot of those Hostel and Saw efforts had. It's just like a way smarter, more sinister version of those types of films. You can't help but have it into my top 20 at least. And when one of the characters escapes and the narrative unspools in a reverse direction, it's really a different way to tell the story as well, and I thought quite effective. And it has WTF moments aplenty. So that's my number four. Number five, Lamberto Bava's Demons. This one is an early an early exploration for me into Italian horror, although I didn't know it at the time. I just didn't really know what was up with all these dubbed voices. And this one is, I believe, lensed in Germany partly, but it's an Italian production from 1985, wherein some college co-eds get invited to a screening of a mysterious film playing in Berlin. And they get, accosted on a subway platform by a man wearing a mysterious mask, almost like a Phantom of the Paradise or a Phantom of the Opera. Thrilled, they figure, oh, we got a free show at the cinema, and they go to the screening, and the movie within a movie features a demonic book and an incantation, and through some schism in the mechanism, turn the attendees into zombies. And this is not some sort of meditation on the deleterious effects horror films have on its watchers. There's no subtext. It's all text as the characters turn into mindless rampaging zombies. A few of the survivors have to do battle against them, and all of it takes place in the confines of a cinema, and it's just rip-roaring hilarious entertainment. There's a sequel too that has a similar conceit. The medium of television transforms the denizens of a high-rise apartment building into rampaging zombies, and there's a particular, I guess, a birthday party taking place, and a bunch of the attendees get transformed with hilarious results. There's also some overlapping characters, or overlapping, I guess, actors playing different characters in both movies, but Lamberto Bava's demons, iconic image of the three demons emerging from the stairwell that's actually made its way onto the Really Awful Movies podcast merchandise and logo. So a buddy of ours who did some illustrations for Death by Umbrella, the 100 Weirdest Horror Movie Weapons, did a rendering of that iconic scene. And we've used some music from the movie, and we even approached the producers to get some of this stuff copyright cleared for our podcast. So they were shocked, and that we would even ask, as opposed to just using it ad libitum and just going with it, because that's people's want these days. And number six, Dr. Butcher, M.D., another early Italian horror that had me completely mystified when I first saw it at 12 years old at my friend Aaron's overnight birthday party, I believe it was, his place out in the country. We rented this thing based solely on the title, and weren't watching it closely enough to figure out why a group of Western doctors would go to some ridiculous island, and as pieces of corpses went missing from a local New York City hospital. Dr. Butcher, M.D. is wild, to say the least, and it looks like the work of many hands and different films that were possibly cobbled together in post, as they don't seem to relate to one another too much. The back half and the front half seem to be only, you know, very tangentially related, but that makes for a really funny proceeding. So Dr. Butcher, M.D., utterly ridiculous cannibal movie, but it's one of the few Italian cannibal movies that's actually fun and not just wholly gruesome, and there's an absence of animal cruelty, which was prevalent throughout the genre, and that's what makes it the cannibal genre so off-putting to so many, and with good reason. Number seven, Night of the Living Dead, George Romero. Was debating whether to include Dawn of the Dead, which is often my preferred film, but I figured I had to include one member of the canonical films, and I figured might as well include Night of the Living Dead, as it's my first horror film ever that I caught on TV one Halloween night when I was pretty young. I might have been 10 or 11. And for the sheer fact that at the time, George Romero cast a black man as the hero, which was way ahead of its time in the period this was released, but also because the zombie conceit is that they can take on as a metaphor pretty much anything. And in Dawn of the Dead. There's obviously the consumerism subtext as zombies go to one of their favorite places when they were alive and not the undead, which was the local mall, and they bang into the windows quite humorously. But zombies have taken on a life of their own, obviously, and again, easy metaphor for just about anything, because anytime a zombie is doing anything, it dumbs it down considerably. So if you have a bunch of mall shoppers around holiday shopping season, it casts that phenomenon into a different light when you're seeing it through the eyes of someone who has no willpower or decision-making capabilities. Number eight, The Shining. One of the films that gets better each time you watch it. This Stanley Kubrick film just reveals just so many hidden gems with repeated viewings. And Rob Ager, A-G-E-R, has a series of videos through a Collative Learning, his site, that brought to the forefront different interpretations of what has been going on in the different parts of the film that viewers may have that may have gone unnoticed to a lot of viewers, including examining some of the backstory between Jack Torrance and his son, and whether he was abused sexually, and what the bear, or the man in the bear costume, means in that infamous scene with the middle-aged man on the bed. The Shining is the quintessential haunted house movie. And as much as I like the likes of Burnt Offerings and Poltergeist and that, there's something about The Shining that stands above and apart from all those efforts. And despite Stephen King's antipathy toward it, there's just so many incredible visuals. And the mise-en-scene is so spectacular. You have really jarring and geometrically impossible rooms and a layout of the hotel that just doesn't make sense. So it adds to a very discomforting and very very awkward feeling, and it inspires a lot of weird vibes, to be frank. Is it whether it's the carpet that has a sort of chevron appearance that leads you in one direction when Danny is riding around on his tricycle throughout the halls, or the almost Dario Argento-esque bedrooms that feature all sorts of jarring colors that are almost seemingly designed to make the viewer sick, whether it's like weird combinations of brown and hues of purple and yellow, and it just adds to the surreal nature of it. But also what really stands out is having phantasmagorical aspects of it, not depicted through shapes like ghost shapes, but actually depicted as if they were living people rather than ephemera and ghosts. I'm thinking Lloyd the bartender, when Mr. Torrance is hallucinating and besotted with the drink, Lloyd the bartender appears as an actual character, and I think this really heightens the scares and really gives this whole this movie a completely different approach. And I think it's just quintessential winter horror viewing, and The Overlook is one of the most iconic and scary, right along with the mansion on the hill in Psycho, one of the iconic buildings in the horror pantheon, that's for damn sure. The Shining is almost a no-brainer, and that would be the one, the first film in my list, or second film in my list, I guess, that would be included in among the all-time best horror films as well, along with George Romero's Night of the Living Dead. Number nine, about which the same can be said. John Carpenter's Halloween, the perfect horror film, flawless, whether it's the appearance of Michael Myers by the drying laundry, or whether it's Laurie Strode holding herself up in the closet. The shapes and the shadows and the deserted streets is the quintessential Halloween movie, as its name would suggest, but also an argument could be made that it's the best horror film of all time quite easily, and you'd get no argument from me, obviously, because I've mentioned at the outset I hold it in highest regard, and it, along with Maniac, are the slashers par excellence. So when the genre first started with the likes of Mario Bava's Bay of Blood and Black Christmas, which followed shortly thereafter, the horror boom caused just a spate it opened the floodgates for so many slashers to come out, and none of which carries the gravitas and the incredible, just the incredible camera work and the wide lens aesthetic look of Halloween. And although subsequent efforts explained more of Michael Myers' backstory as it relates to Laurie Strode, that was really probably unnecessary, and it left viewers questioning the motivations behind this killer. And there were none really offered, other than I guess you could say some people are born evil, as you see in the first scene, but there's no really explanation in the narrative as to why the child would grow into this monster. The shape, number 9, easily could have been number 1 on anyone's list. Number 10, the recent remake was highly polarizing, and that is Suspiria. And I could have easily included Opera in the list, and I was going to, but at the last minute decided against the tie and to opt for the cultural impact of Suspiria and the fact that I've seen it more times than Opera, so to give Dario Argento his due here. As an aside, as I'm going through the list, I tried not to repeat myself with directors, so because my favorites could have easily included, let's say, 3 films by David Cronenberg, or 2 to 3 films from John Carpenter, or George Romero as well. So I didn't want to do that. So for a little bit of variety, I wanted to keep everything a little bit separate. So Dario Argento here, from the moment the lead character is in the cab and it's raining, you get this very Kafkaesque, very surreal vibe that has continued throughout. And Dario Argento is able to take subject matter that's very elevated and turn it into something really gross and unnerving and disgusting. So that's taking a ballet school and using that as a backdrop for unspeakable horrors. And I think very few people could have pulled off such a conceit, and he's one of them. So not to mention, you got to throw in the soundtrack is just, with the breathy references to, I think, Witch and that kind of thing. But just another, the ballet school would be another building that's an indelible horror landmark, and that would be included along with maybe the dilapidated mansion from The Changeling as all-time great horror movie buildings. So Suspiria at my number 10. Number 11, A Nightmare on Elm Street, tied with A Nightmare on Elm Street 3. I figured I'd throw a bone to both films because as much as I like the Wes Craven original, I really, really liked the Insane Asylum sequel. And 2 is kind of underrated as well, and you can check out Jeff and I's podcast about that one. But number 3 has Heather Langenkamp's Nancy return as a therapist in this asylum, and there's the bonus of Patty Arquette, who's quite a great actress, and also, speaking of which, Lawrence Fishburne plays an orderly in an early role. And Nightmare on Elm Street 3, in particular, Dream Warrior stands out for the fantastic Dawkin theme song, but also what I would call vain puppeteering, where the wrists are opened up and Freddy plays one of his victims like a marionette, and I thought that was such a wicked and surreal image. But Nightmare on Elm Street generally, though, stands above in its depiction of the supernatural, and as much as I like Tobe Hooper and Steven Spielberg's supernatural depictions in Poltergeist, there's something just so eerie and so dreamlike and such a nightmare scenescape that the cinematography creates in Nightmare on Elm Street, and that's across the board. I have not seen James Earl Haley, I want to say, the replacement for England, but for all the nightmares I've seen, and even Freddy versus Jason, it has a certain mystique and a certain there's a definite understanding of the character's milieu, and he's one of the great antagonists in horror, easily in my top 5. And you have to give kudos to A Nightmare on Elm Street, which obviously young Johnny Depp may be miscast in the first one, but the incredible John Saxon and Heather Langenkamp as Nancy, I mean, such a final girl, if you want to even call her that, with such physical and moral agency and internal strength to be able to battle off a character that's obliquely a pedophile, a child killer. So a dark, twisted, nightmarish film that is the most original film on this list, and a strong case could be made that it's one of the best horrors of all time. If you don't have it in your top 10, I think there's you have a profound misunderstanding of the genre. Number 12, David Cronenberg, finally, Hometown Boy. And I this was belabored as well, because it was jumping back and forth between this one, Dead Ringers, and The Brood. Dead Ringers I hold in such a high esteem because of, I mean, you know, Jeremy Irons is just so fantastic, and the technical achievement of having him filmed while he's playing his twin, and how they managed to do that is incredible. But I finally decided that by process of elimination to get rid of it, because it's not a true horror film, even though with the specula and the gynecological instruments that the twin doctors had developed are quite horrifying. It's not a, I guess, true horror film as we would come to understand it. Although my next entry into the series is going to stands in contraindication to that. The Fly is a metaphor for aging, or it's a metaphor for a lot of things, but Jeff Goldblum is at his very best here, and it's just a dark, unbelievable remake. It's one of the top two remakes of all time, and the other one is on my list as well. But the relationship he has with his then wife is, or girlfriend at the time, is it really brings things to the forefront. And but Jeff Goldblum really is superb as the doctor who develops this means of switching his genetic material with, well, initially he tries with a, I think it's a baboon. It's been a while, apologies, since I've seen it, but then gets his DNA mixed up with a fly. And I think some critics have said it could have been, would have been more effective if he had maybe been a spider, because that really is, he doesn't really fly anywhere in particular. He just sort of roams around, but and his movements are more arachnid like. So, but that's a small quibble. It's the everything from the sleek Italian futurist design of the machine that he used to transport his genetic material, to again the performances and just the really icky practical effects, that the fly has to be here. Now again, when you're talking about something that may not be a pure horror film, at my number 13 is Deliverance, based on the James Dickey novel, which I highly recommend and have on my bookshelf. A bunch of weekend warrior types venture into the Georgian, that's Georgia the state, not Georgia the country, in the Caucasus Mountains. It's a film where a bunch of campers are attacked by these backwoods hillbillies. It's the quintessential Hicksploitation film. And as much as I like the likes of The Hills Have Eyes and maybe some of Rob Zombie's offerings there, like House of a Thousand Corpses, Hicksploitation gets no better than this. I mean, the banjo playing scene and the camaraderie and the really iconic Burt Reynolds lead character as the alpha male trying to lead his more softer, pudgier, less macho buddies through the wilderness in a survival mission. As far as survival horror goes, it can't be beat. Next on my list, Hellraiser, another one that's just completely unique by merging the S&M world with horror, and Clive Barker's source material is, I think, stands apart by being the goriest movie that's also supernatural. So you have this lament configuration box. It's like a Rubik's Cube, and it brings some creatures from the beyond that include the Cenobites, which is a character who's got pins and needles in his head, like a pin cushion. And it's just one of the great characters in horror, and one of my favorites growing up, for sure. Subsequent sequels deviated a little too much from the source material for my liking, although they have some of their own merits. They focused a little too much on the villains at the expense of the protagonist, but I think they got the balance right in the first Hellraiser. Next on the list, American Psycho. Christian Bale's performance is off the charts. This Mary Harron directed effort is one of my all-time favorites, and particularly because it envelops a milieu that you don't associate with horror films. Psychopathic behavior of a different kind, which would be Wall Street, callous, indifferent Wall Street douchebags. But American Psycho is, would make for an excellent double bill with The Wolf of Wall Street. And Christian Bale just completely inhabits the Bateman character and gives it everything he's got, as he's wont to do. I mean, he's one of the finest working actors today. American Psycho, easy inclusion on this list. The Texas Chainsaw Massacre, one of the first films I ever saw, and it continually amazes me how Tobe Hooper directed Poltergeist, which has a completely different feel from this, and this 1974 effort, just the buzzing flies, and you can almost smell the decaying flesh. The book Chainsaw Confidential gives a really good account of the troubles that they experienced on the production, most notably being the heat and the fact that none of them really knew what the hell they were doing. So I think it was a 2 or 3 week shoot, and they had a lot of non-actors and just volunteers helping out, and the fact that even that it got made is a miracle. Me and my buddies rented it from the local video store, and we were so ready to be terrified, and with good reason, because when the opening credits roll, it fools you into thinking it's cinema verite almost, or that it's it makes some lofty claim that it's based on a true story, but it's influenced in part by the Ed Gein Wisconsin House of Horrors, but there's no historical precedent to chainsaws massacring anyone in any way. But pre-internet, there's no way to fact check this, and we as kids thought it was based on something real, and Tobe Hooper masterfully gave us a horror that really embodied the less is more ethos, and there's really very little in the way of chainsawing of anybody. Now contrast that starkly with the next entry in my list, 17, City of the Living Dead. This is Lucio Fulci, the godfather of Italian gore, and featuring rubber sex dolls, psychics, tough-talking cops, people getting buried alive, a very bored-looking Christopher George wandering around a cemetery. What's not to like, really? Now, I labored over this one as well, as Lucio Fulci is such an icon, but I couldn't... it was, Zombie 2, it was The Beyond. I was just... didn't know what to put first, but, I mean, it's... you pick them. City of the Living Dead, I like because of the psychic element, and also the Hanging Priest, and the soundtrack is just so bang on. So for Italian gore hounds, you can't go wrong with City of the Living Dead, but if you want to throw in The Beyond, which also has just an amazing, swamp landscape, and this mysterious house in the middle of nowhere inhabited by the ghost of this painter, that one's a great one to include as well. Number 18 is a no-brainer. Spielberg here offers us one of the most iconic movie monsters of all time, not to mention great lines like "you're going to need a bigger boat," but the demise of the Great White Hunter is something that it's a scene that I love. It's so funny. The performances are just great, and Spielberg was really getting his Hitchcock rocks off in the way he approached some of the scenes, particularly when Roy Scheider is looking out into the water to see what's going on, and there's different aspects of his of what he sees are being depicted in different times with quick cuts, and it's totally Hitchcock, and you could see how Spielberg was informed by that, and it's just pure monster movie storytelling, and the technical problems are much described in terms of Bruce and the issues they had. So again, much like the Texas Chainsaw Massacre, the less is more you know, positioning of it really serves it in good stead. And so when that you know, bloody raft washes up on the beach, wow, it's just it caused such a sensation, and it's, you know, often imitated, seldom duplicated, although I really, really like especially some of the Italian Jaws ripoffs. Orca is fun. Beneath is a fun killer catfish movie. Alligator is a great, you know, obviously alligator attack movie. Piranha probably stands above some of the movies that came after Jaws, but there's only one Jaws. Number 19, as I alluded to, The Changeling, one of the greatest Canadian horror films of all time. George C. Scott and that kind of hoary cliche of the person who inhabits a creepy house. But this one is really an outstanding, if not the most outstanding, ghost horror film of all time. It also introduced to the horror world the bouncing ball, which has become a cliche across supernatural films. But it has so many just powerful scenes, you know, with the iconic wheelchair, but also the drowning scene, much like Burnt Offerings, is a similar, which, you know, I really love and I really like as a haunted house, broadly speaking, film. But The Changeling is just superb on every level, and it just so top-notch, and it has to be, along with The Shining, that one of the best of its type. Finally, Invasion of the Body Snatchers, the second best remake of all time, maybe after The Fly, with pod people mysteriously appearing, and much like zombies, can take on whatever metaphor you can ascribe to them. Here you could say that it's the maybe the creeping influence of collectivism. You could say that it's just groupthink. You could ascribe it, their behavior to overly devout religious adherence. It speaks to so many potential aspects of humanity, and Donald Sutherland is so superb, and he's become a meme when he points with his fantastic mustache. But Leonard Nimoy is great as well, and one of my favorite lines is Donald Sutherland is a health inspector, and questioning a chef about what's in his soup and finding a rat turd in it. And the chef says it's not a rat turd, it's a caper. And he says, if it's a caper, why don't you eat it? They're just little tiny gems sprinkled throughout one of the greatest horror films of all time, even if it falls more on the side of sci-fi. On the side now of glaring omissions, you could say maybe The Thing, another John Carpenter, and I wrestled with this, but I think I successfully was able to exclude it based on my criteria for one movie per director. So many people like The Thing. My co-host Jeff would probably put it in his top 10, and it's just the idea alone is enough, but Kurt Russell's amazing too, and it's a just missed the cut kind of thing. And when you have the 20 to 50, it's an easy inclusion there. You could throw in Alien or Aliens there as well, and I could maybe make a case that the Ridley Scott one is more of a sci-fi effort and hence could be excluded, although possibly the amount of time that's passed since I last saw either of those. The Exorcist as well, just because I know this one resonates a lot with Catholics, not so much with yours truly, but that would be more in the latter part of my top 100 horror films of all time. And then again, I wrestled with Cronenberg and could have easily thrown Videodrome in there as well. Modern horrors, the extent that I haven't had the chance to watch them enough is why they probably haven't vaulted into my top, but you could easily throw in films that I really, really liked that were recent, and that includes Bone Tomahawk from a couple years ago, Backcountry, an outstanding animal attack film, Hereditary, really impactful, really thought-provoking, Goodnight Mommy, Austrian film that's off the charts, creepy as fuck, The Descent, that will have claustrophobic people just cowering in fear. It Follows, I thought, was pretty terrific as an indie horror effort. Shaun of the Dead, 28 Days Later, some of the most superb UK horrors ever. Really loved The Witch, and I was wrestling with Open Water as a tie with Jaws, but because of the cultural impact of Jaws and the fact that Open Water wouldn't exist without Jaws, I decided to include it. Just missed the cut. Slime City, Greg Lamberson, friend of the show. Jeff helped produce Lamberson's Killer Rack movie. Slime City is so much fun about a guy who drinks this mysterious liquid and turns into a melting slime creature. It's to this day, I was almost going to include it in my top 20, but at the last minute decided maybe The Changeling would be a better fit, because it was just so almost too close to call. I throw in Street Trash as well, but again, that toes the line as to whether that's more exploitation versus horror. Personal favorite of mine is Umberto Lenzi's ridiculous zombie contagion movie called Nightmare City. I have the shirt, and it's so much fun. An American Werewolf in London, and The Howling, along with Ginger Snaps, easily 1, 2, 3, the finest werewolf movies of all time, and could have merited inclusion. Also, both versions of Nosferatu, the 1922 one, but also the Werner Herzog one with Klaus Kinski. I debated including one of those, but I just hadn't seen them enough times to really warrant that. And my two favorite vampire movies are George Romero's Martin and Bram Stoker's Dracula, but I just felt like they just didn't hold enough sway with me to be included here. So there you have it, my top 20 favorite horror films of all time. Quick shout out to Veronica in San Joaquin County, California, for reaching out to us and for listening to the show. And she mentioned that she bought a copy of the book, and she's a big fan. So again, mine's bigger than yours. The 100 Wackiest Action Movies is coming out next month and will be in retail locations at W.H. Smith, Barnes & Noble, Chapters Indigo in Canada. There's been some delays thanks to COVID, but that book is available for fans of the action genre. So hope you pick up a copy and enjoy. And hope you enjoyed this list, and we shall talk to you soon. Take care. Thank you.